Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, 9th Canto, Chapter 14. King Puruva, enchanted by Urvashi. Text 7 through 9. Sarvadeva Ganopeto.
Sarvadeva Ganopeto.
Mahendro Gurum Anvayat.
Mahendro Gurum Anvayat.
Sarasura Vinasho Bhut. Samarastarakamaya. A woman, the wife of Brihaspati. Translation. King Indra, accompanied by all kinds of demigods, joined the side of Brihaspati. Thus there was a great fight, destroying both demons and demigods, only for the sake of Tara, Brihaspati's wife. Text 8. When Lord Brahma was fully informed by Angira about the entire incident, he severely chastised the moon god, Soma. Thus, Lord Brahma delivered Tara to her husband, who could then understand that she was pregnant. Text 9. Brihaspati said, "You foolish woman, your womb, which was meant for me to impregnate, has been impregnated by someone other than me. Immediately deliver your child. Immediately deliver it. Be assured that after the child is delivered, I shall not burn you to ashes. I know that although you are unchaste, you wanted a son. Therefore, I shall not punish you." Purport. Tara was married to Brihaspati, and therefore, as a chaste woman, she should have been impregnated by him. But instead, she preferred to be impregnated by Soma, the moon god, and therefore she was unchaste. Although Brihaspati accepted Tara from Brahma, when he saw that she was pregnant, he wanted her to deliver a son immediately. Tara certainly very much feared her husband, and she thought she might be punished after giving birth. Thus, Brihaspati assured her that he would not punish her, for although she was unchaste and had become pregnant illicitly, she wanted a son. We are in a very inconceivable part of the Bhagavatam. This section of Bhagavatam will be a test of your bhakti fidelity. Or should we just quickly get through this section? Those of you who are encumbered by advanced education, what can you think about all this? Describe in such a chapter. It's not simply the dealings between Soma and Tara and Brihaspati, but how did everything start with Lord Gobardakshai Vishnu from the lake of his navel sprouting a lotus flower upon which Brahma was born? This is supreme artistry. But there's a natural tendency in us to reject such descriptions as mythological because such activities by Garbhodakshaya Vishnu are not within the realm of our everyday ordinary experience. And my point is that there's something about everyday ordinary experience that desensitizes you to the transcendental reality. There's something about ordinary, everyday experience that makes foremost in your life simply financial needs, sensual needs, social needs for respect, and so forth. So what we consider to be ordinary, everyday reality is actually quite detrimental. But we have difficulty seeing that because of attachment. By hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, our mundane attachments start to dissipate. Shrimvatam sakata krishna punya shravana kirtana hridyantasta abhadrani vidunoti sirhitsatam. This is Bhagavatam mysticism. if we can just not be so aggressive with our mundane knives, which are supposedly sharpened by everyday daily experience. But actually, we become dull by everyday daily experience. But there's something about contact with the material energy that causes us to become proud by our everyday daily experience. I know, I've studied, I have life experience. And what is Shukadev Goswami's conclusion about all that? Pashyannapi na pashyati. Although you're sufficiently experienced, still you cannot see. That is the great benediction of material civilization today. You're sufficiently experienced. You've studied hard, but you still can't see what's going on. And we start with Lord Garbhadakshay Vishnu, and then there's Brahma. Brahma, as you heard in the beginning of this chapter, had a son named Atri. And Atri, believe it or not, impregnated his wife Anasuya with his tears of jubilation. Now, what do you think of that? You have gone to great institutions of learning. You have done some experience in the corporate world, and now you're hearing about such incidents in Srimad Bhagavatam. The natural tendency, of course, is since I cannot do these things, and since I've never seen such things, how can these things exist? And if people start to believe these things, what will be the hope for them for material advancement? Everything has to be measured in terms of how it contributes to economic advancement. Otherwise, what is the use? That is the bottom line today. Forget integrity, forget being genuine, forget wisdom. Just think of the financial bottom line. How does our acceptance of various notions contribute to the consumer society? All right, so Atri Muni impregnated Anasuya with his tears of jubilation, and then Soma was born. Soma is described in the Bhagavatam as a demigod in charge of herbs and the stars, or sometimes he's considered the moon deva. There's a note given by Srila Prabhupada that in other parts of the Vedic texts, it is stated that Soma was born from the mind of the Supreme Personality Godhead. How do you resolve all this? The Acharyas point out that some descriptions of Bhagavatam are from different millenniums, and therefore things were done differently. So in one millennium, Soma is born from the mind of the Supreme Personality Godhead. In another millennium, he's born from the tears of his father impregnating his mother. If Krishna is Purushottam, the Supreme Person, why should he do everything the same every time? It's amazing. Srila Prabhupada brought up this point even in reference to the fall of the jiva issue. And devotees were battling. Did the jiva come from Brahman? Or did the jiva come from Vaikuntha? And on and on they went. And in the midst of Srila Prabhupada's pointing out that originally we are with Krishna and separation from Krishna is impossible, he said, and by the way, Krishna doesn't have to do things the same way every time. In the midst of this intense philosophical description, analyzing the jiva issue this way and that way, in the middle, just one sentence, Prabhupada wrote, anyway, Krishna doesn't have to do the same. He doesn't have to do things the same way every time. This is personalism. But just see how our minds are predisposed to, there must be a mechanistic process that is executed perfectly the same time, every time, the same way every time. There must be such a process. And we are making a great concession to admit that there is an ultimate designer with an ultimate design. How great we are. Therefore, how can you stretch our credibility by daring to suggest that the design could be different, differently executed at different times? In other words, there has to be a limit. How much can our minds handle? We are pious persons. How much can we assimilate? How much can we digest? The Bhagavatam is meant to constantly expand the limits of your conceptions. By constantly hearing Bhagavatam, you become humbled. You realize that your mind is shackled by so many conscious and unconscious conceptions, which you arbitrarily accepted, yet you cling to them very dogmatically. By hearing chapters such as this, you become freed from that clinging to these arbitrary conceptions. It's amazing when we analyze our foundational assumptions and see that indeed they're just that, assumptions. But how can the ordinary person means your everyday materialist, either materialist by innocence or by deliberate choice, how do they get the fortitude, the courage, the incisiveness to cut through all this, all the assumptions that are forming their consciousness? It's too much. It's too much for people to do. And they have their financial pressures, they have their physical and mental pressures, they have their social pressures. And at the same time, they're supposed to get to the root of all the issues about existence. Most people will say, I can't handle it. It's too much. Hearing Srimad Bhagavatam is the easy way how to cut to the chase, the easy way how to get your fingers on the pulse of reality. You do pay a price by hearing Bhagavatam. You have to suspend your dearmost mundane conceptions. But if you allow the Bhagavatam to do its wonders upon you, you'll feel quite relieved of those material burdens, those conceptions, and the spiritual world will begin to open up to you. This is why Lord Chaitanya stressed to his followers, all those who come after Lord Chaitanya, that Bhagavatam is your life and soul. Before you are liberated, read Srimad Bhagavatam, and after you are liberated, go on reading Srimad Bhagavatam. All right, what do we find has happened? Soma, Anyway, what Soma is showing is that life in the heavenly planets amongst the demigods, you know, does also have some problems. We shouldn't take these characters to be ordinary, these personalities to be ordinary. Soma, Brihaspati, so on and so forth, Indra. But the way life is on the heavenly planets is such that an intelligent person wants to directly go back to Godhead. The demigods themselves admit this in the fifth canto of Bhagavatam. They say, if we have any punya, any pious activities left in our account, we want to take birth on earth. Particularly, we want to take birth in Bharat, in India, and particularly in a holy place in India, because we can very easily perfect our life. The human form of life is very short compared to demigod life. and conditions on Earth are mixed happiness and distress. It's a middle planetary system. Whereas conditions in the higher planets, it's just too heavenly. We can't get sufficient motivation to give up our material attachments. Therefore, we'd rather take birth as a human on Earth. If we look at the ISKCON world in general, for the past 40 years, 45 years, if you know about the ISKCON world situation, you'll see it is a fact that, generally speaking, yatras in very, very nice, very pleasant material regions and situations, they've always had great difficulty. Very difficult to attract people to bhakti, and very even more difficult to hold persons in bhakti. That's interesting. Just like, take Hawaii. Some other it happens to be part of my GBC zone. Srila Prabhupada said, if there's one place on earth that's heaven, it's Hawaii. And if you go there, you can see. You'll have to be very transcendental here. You'd have to be a very strong brahmachari. The temperature year-round is 28 degrees, year-round. And in the afternoon, practically every afternoon, a breeze blows in from the ocean laden with droplets of moisture. Fresh fruits are magnificent. The beaches are just like picturesque. But it has proven to be a very difficult place to become a serious devotee. Similarly, Southern California in the USA, even since the time of Srila Prabhupada, difficult to hold serious devotees. And then the Gold Coast of Australia, places with names like Surfer's Paradise, the Sunshine Coast. Very difficult for strong devotees to emerge from such areas. So bhakti is transcendental, there's no doubt. A dedicated devotee can serve anywhere. But nevertheless, human nature is what it is. And not all devotees are immediately paramahansas. So we can see that in these topmost situations in the world of everything being so nice materially, it's difficult for devotees to make spiritual advancement. Some do, they're very rare, but generally the attrition rate of devotees is very high. Just like if you look at the USA, compare California to the East Coast, especially Southern California. Book distributors, they'll say that if you look at New York, people will readily admit there's such a thing as the threefold miseries. Whereas in Southern California, there's a problem in life? What are you talking about? So it's interesting that the demigods have testified in this way. If we have any punya left, we don't want to go on in the heavenly planets. We'd rather take birth on earth with a short lifespan in a situation where there's mixed happiness and distress so that we'll be properly motivated to go back to Godhead. So now, hopefully we've given some background to Soma's problem. He became proud. He had conquered all the three worlds, and pride and ego had overtaken him. And obviously, we don't want such a thing to happen to us in our devotional service, because we know Krishna doesn't like when devotees become proud. Sometimes the question's presented, how is it that you can actually try to execute devotional service in a competent way, and yet at the same time, not think yourself to have any abilities. This is bhakti mysticism. As you advance in spiritual life, you'll find this vision manifest from your heart. That even though others may think you're doing something very expertly, you yourself think, oh, there's so many faults in what I'm doing. I could do much better. And there are devotees who are doing so much better. Perhaps I'm favored with good circumstances, and therefore it seems my devotional service is more important. But when I look at another devotee and the circumstances of that devotee, maybe his body is sick or maybe he's got some other material afflictions he has to deal with and he's still going on serving. When I see that example, then I tell myself, that's a real devotee. I'm just a sunshine devotee. When it's nice and the circumstances are nice and favorable, then my service is very enthusiastic. But when there's some impediment, when there's some upset, then you see where I'm really at. How do these feelings enter the heart? It's mysticism. The bhakti yogi strives so intensely to please Krishna with his intelligence, all his abilities. And yet, the bhakti yogi thinks, I'm bankrupt. I'm just dependent on the Lord's mercy. The mercy of the guru is all I'm made of. Mundane people think that when you have that kind of attitude, that humble attitude, you'll not be able to execute properly. Execution involves belief in your own competence. Execution involves taking stock of your abilities, being confident of them. Then things can happen. That's a mundane conception. But how can you actually serve effectively in Krishna's corporation? How can you serve effectively if you're not impressed by your own abilities? Where will your confidence come from? What kind of dynamics will be there in the core of your being? Soma became proud, and as a result, your pride and lust are very closely related. He confiscated Brihaspati's wife, Tara. And even Brihaspati is going to him saying, please send my wife back, send my wife back. Soma refused. He's so proud. So a fight broke out between the demigods and the demons because Soma recruited the asuras on his side. And Brihaspati had Indra, he had Shiva. So it was a whole cosmic battle. And what does the Sanskrit in today's verse say? Taraka Maya. Simply because of Tara, a woman, the wife of Brihaspati. There's this huge cosmic conflict with big, like, demigods. Mahadev is lined up with Brihaspati. Indra is lined up with Brihaspati. The asuras are lined up with Soma. Taraka Maya. The phrase is self-explanatory. Recently at a festival in New Zealand, we had the great fortune of having the presence of Yadubar Prabhu and Vishakha Mataji, and they were showing the latest Following Srila Prabhupada DVD series. And there was one memory by a devotee of Srila Prabhupada at the New York Rath Yatra in 1976. That was the first Rath Yatra in New York. So the devotee was a young sannyasi, maybe about 25, 26, 27 years old. And he was sitting in a private darshan with Prabhupada, and he had just taken sannyas. So naturally, he was making sure he was very staunch. And so he was sitting before Prabhupada with his danda, clutched very tightly, sitting in proper posture and focusing on Srila Prabhupada. And suddenly Srila Prabhupada asked him a question. What do you think of the New York women? The sannyasi was like, whoa, held on to his danda tightly. How do I answer this question? How do I not incriminate myself? So Prabhupada asks him again, tell me, what do you think of the New York women? 26, 77-year-old sannyasi, just taken sannyas a few months before, and so he just kept quiet, just clutched his danda tightly and looked at Prabhupada like, what to say? And Prabhupada waited for him to answer. He didn't answer. So Prabhupada, he just started talking. Aren't they beautiful? The young sannyasi, his mind was just in shreds. He just, they're so beautiful, Prabhupada went on. They're so beautiful. And then Prabhupada started giving explanation. It's because of them that all this urban development in New York is going on. You see all these skyscrapers. You see all this traffic in Manhattan. All this urban activity. It's all because of the women. They're so beautiful. Therefore, the men are working so hard. Prabhupada explained, it's all Vishnu Maya. Because of the beauty of the women, the men are working so hard, putting up skyscrapers, banking, finance. All this is because of the women. So similarly, in this verse, you see, Taraka Maya. How did the situation apparently resolve itself? Lord Brahma, hearing about this huge cosmic conflict, he went to Soma and chastised him very severely. And then Brahma himself took Tara back to her husband. There was a little complication, however, in that Brihaspati could see that his wife was expecting. And so therefore, we have the verse in which he's chastising her. You foolish woman, your womb was meant for me to impregnate, has been impregnated by someone other than me. Immediately deliver your child. Immediately deliver it. Demigods, their bodies are much more powerful than human bodies. So Brihaspati could say like that. Told his wife, you have the power to immediately make the child born. And he understood her fear that after she gave birth to the child, her husband would burn her to ashes because of her unchasteness. But he assured her, I won't do that. Just see how valued children are amongst the demigods. There's no question of Brihaspati saying you should terminate the pregnancy or anything like that. Now, immediately give birth. Because even taking birth in such circumstances, but amongst demigods, is a special birth. I also seen Prabhupada advise unfortunate situations in ISKCON like that. If there's some situation, just as we've heard about with Soma and Tara and Brihaspati, and Prabhupada would advise the woman, you raise the child carefully. It's not going to be an ordinary child. Of course, this doesn't justify such activity at all, but these things happen, and it's happening amongst the demigods. It just shows us how volatile material existence is, how problematic material existence is. We need to simplify our lifestyle so that we can pass through this complicated world unscathed by complications. We'll hear that Tara, in great shame, immediately did give birth to the child. And the child was indeed very beautiful with a golden hue. The conflict now takes a new form. Who is actually the father of such a beautiful child? Both Brihaspati and Soma, the moon god, wanted the child. So another battle started. And again, Brahma had to enter into the situation. You see, it's not easy being Brahma. he's got to sort out situations like this. Sounds much easier to be a brahmachari, yes? than to be Brahma. Fighting again broke out between Brihaspati and the moon god, both of whom claimed, "This is my child, not yours." All the saints and demigods present asked Tara whose child the newborn baby actually was, but because she was ashamed, she could not immediately answer. She wouldn't tell. And even her own, even the baby himself, her child, will chastise her. "Oh, unchaste woman, just tell the truth. Just say who my father actually is." Still, the perplexity went on, and Brahma had to enter into the situation, take Tara aside and ask her, "Whose child is this actually?" And Tara, with great shame and very slowly, told him, "It's Soma's child." Immediately, Soma came, took away the beautiful son. So this is life in the heavenly planets. Extraordinary, powerful beings, yet they also have their complications. How are we to process all this information? It's far outside of our ordinary experience. But again, my point is that our ordinary everyday experience is highly suspect. And unless you're able to show people that their ordinary everyday experience is highly suspect, they maintain a sense of pride and false confidence. "I know what I'm doing. I'm in touch with reality. I may not understand the spiritual science, but I know how to live in this world." But if you pull that rug out from under them, you don't understand how the world works, you don't know how to live in this world, then you can catch people in moments of perplexity and insecurity. Maybe I don't understand what's going on. Maybe there's so much I don't know. Well, let me hear from you. What do you have to say? Maybe there are beings as powerful as Soma and Brihaspati. What do I know? So when persons become in that state of mind, it's easier to present Bhagavatam to them. She reminds me of a point Srila Prabhupada made. His definition of management. He said management means, he didn't say how to organize the finances, how to deal with logistics. He said management means to create an interest in Krishna where there is none. That's management. So if you can get people to drop their conscious and unconscious assumptions that are burdening them, you do them a great favor while simultaneously putting them in contact with the bhakti process. Their assumptions are so deep and so unconscious that it's hard for people themselves to discriminate. It's hard for them to separate themselves from such assumptions. I'll give you an example. There's one devotee couple in Christchurch, New Zealand, and they're both children of devotees, and they married, and they were in their house, and around 4 o'clock in the morning, the earthquake hit Christchurch a few months ago last year, and the Mataji, she's from Mumbai. She has no experience of earthquakes or no understanding of earthquakes. There's no question of knowledge filter. It was just such things don't exist because she never experienced it. So she was asleep, and the house started shaking. What's the first thing, based on her knowledge bank and her conscious and unconscious assumptions, what's the first thing she thought? She yelled out at her husband, "Are you walking up and down in the house, pacing and chanting, shaking the whole house?" She's acting according to her fund of knowledge. The house must be shaking because my husband is up early chanting japa and pacing. She had no experience of earthquakes. They don't have earthquakes in Mumbai yet, do they? They have floods, so many things, but not earthquakes. So she's acting according to her fund of knowledge. Then the house keeps shaking and dishes are flying off the shelves and everything's falling on the pictures are falling off the wall. And so then her husband calls out, "It's an earthquake, it's an earthquake." So there's an example of how you act according to the knowledge and experience that you have. And it's not that you think, well, maybe there's something beyond my experience. No, you're confident. I know what's going on. It's you. You're pacing while chanting Hare Krishna, shaking the house. The natural psychology of the woman to blame her husband just manifests. You. So my point is that, and I asked the couple, could I use this as an example? I said, "Oh, yes, please. Yes. It shows you how bound we are by such conceptions. we don't know how deep it goes. So therefore, when people approach Bhagavatam, they need help in relieving their burden of assumptions. If you can relieve their pride and their arrogance in a gentle way by presenting that you actually are not so expert, in material life. I often explain that it's quite a compliment to call people materialists, because to call someone a materialist implies they're expert in material life, but they're not. All their material activities are problematic. Eating, sleeping, mating, defending, totally destructive and problematic. What you see in terms of material expertise is in this chapter, the demigods. They know how to have a prosperous, enjoyable material life. But we don't see that on the earth today. We don't see that amongst human beings today. Every one of their material affairs causes them great problems. So if we can point that out, it helps to relieve their attachments to so many mundane conceptions. There is so much information available that can be used to show people that, why should you reject Bhagavatam? You don't understand the material world that you're living in. You don't understand your economic system. You don't understand your political system. You don't understand the environment. Meanwhile, here we have the bhakti process. And mystically, of course, as people participate in that bhakti process, their defenses start to crumble. Of course, we have to analyze our own hearts. Are we really dealing with this information in Bhagavatam, or are we just quickly turning the pages? Let's get to some part of the Bhagavatam that makes more sense. Nashta prayeshu bhadreshu nityam bhagavata sevaya. By daily hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, eternally, the doorway to the spiritual world opens. The dirty things in our heart become destroyed. The Bhagavatam is no ordinary text. Just because it doesn't follow chronological order, why does that diminish its value? We are so mechanistically minded, so reductionist minded, consciously and unconsciously, that we impose those prejudices on the Bhagavatam. Whereas the Bhagavatam clearly says in the beginning, Paramo Naratsaranam Satam, it's meant for Paramahansas who are pure in heart, who are free from envy. So this foremost spiritual text demands a high standard. So the question is, do we want to come up to the proper level or do we not? The more we can help people to assimilate Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, the more our mission will be successful. Because ultimately, we rest upon Shastra. Are there any questions? Yes.
Thank you, Maharaj, for visiting Radha Gopinath Mandir. Thank you for your class. Maharaj, you are mentioning that these pastimes are mentioned in Srimad Bhagavatam, like this particular pastime and some pastimes like this are there in Puranas also. And you said this is to explain how material world is very volatile and even in the heavenly planets, things are not comfortable actually. And you were mentioning in the class that material world is full of complications and this is what this pastime teaches us. And you said we should simplify our lives. So can you please explain kindly about, you know, how we can simplify our lives and how?
This particular period in human history requires simplification because the world situation is so volatile even when understood in an ordinary way. It's like in Australia, there are many devotees who work just right under the top level in the banking and financial industry. They say they cannot get to the top level because of unconscious, unstated ethnic considerations. So just the right under the top level is just full of devotees from India. And so they say that the truth is no one knows what's going on in the world financial situation. No one understands it, but you cannot tell the people that. You have to impart confidence to the people. I may speak more about this at our, you know, at our university program later in the day. No one actually knows what's going on. Therefore, the intelligent person streamlines his life to pass through a period of great complexity and uncertainty. No matter what ashram you're in, the intelligent person understands. Material existence is a storm-tossed sea in general, but right now, even amidst the storm-tossed sea of material existence, this is a particularly rough ocean right now. And so one has to think in that way in terms of any plans for material expansion. That's the advice I give. Anything else? Yes.
Thank you, Maharaj, for a nice class. I wanted to know, that, as you said in the class itself, that this is a complicated world. And so many problems are there. Whether it is in heaven or in earth, everywhere the complications are here. At the same time, you are mentioning that when you are having everything very nice, give an example of Hawaii, then the consciousness doesn't remain strong in Krishna consciously. You become loose in Krishna consciousness. So we see in our Radha Gopinath temple also, in the beginning years we were having lots of struggles and complications, but somehow it is becoming smoother and smoother. We get lots of facilities, lots of, so say, allure, means lots of blessings, and everybody is giving us lots of, so to say, encouragement. What should we do in that circumstances, because our Krishna consciousness might become loose in these circumstances? So what a devotee should do, that in that circumstances his Krishna consciousness doesn't become loose, but he becomes more and more committed what it was before.
In one purport in Bhagavatam, it is explained, it might be Bhagavad Gita actually, that when a devotee is in nice circumstances, he thinks these circumstances of nicety and pleasantness are there as facilities for me to increase my service. The devotee analyzes in that way, that any apparently nice circumstances are there to be engaged in Krishna's service, to increase service to Krishna. And on the converse, the purport says that when there are impediments, difficult situations, setbacks, the devotee thinks, I deserve much worse, but Krishna is kindly minimizing the turbulence I have to face. So when there's so-called happiness, oh, things are good now, everything is just working like clockwork, well, more service should be done for Krishna. The happiness, the pleasantness, the smoothness of the operation is all there for increasing service to Krishna. And when the opposite goes on, you never blame Krishna. You always think, I deserve much worse. Krishna has kindly minimized the turbulence. So in both situations, happiness and distress, Krishna is the winner, the devotee is the winner. No matter what situation you are in, happiness, distress, mixed, good times, bad times, mixed, simply think how to give Krishna to others. Whether you are in Hawaii or Mumbai or... you think, how can others hear about Krishna? And then you'll, in that consciousness, you'll always see there's unlimited service to be done. Unlimited humility to be had. Whatever service we're doing is something His Holiness Bhakti Tirthamar has told me before his departure. Whatever service we've done, we can easily see there's so much more service to do. There's no time to be complacent or proud or confident. We're doing just a drop of just one mustard seed's worth of service compared to an ocean of mustard seeds. Anything else?
Maharaj, talking about the Indian financial market right now, because you might not be aware, in India, there was a very nice rainfall in last season.
Very nice what?
Rainfall, which was 97% normal, 95% normal as per the metro, the weather board has explained. Even if the rainfall was so nice, yet it was the biggest predicament that Indian population is facing right now is that the food inflation in India is right now around 20%. All the vegetables, pulses, milk, everything has been skyrocketed. The price has increased so much. that it is almost the double the price what it was before. Although the rainfall was very nice, the reason is there is a lots of corruption in the political place, and due to that reason the price has skyrocketed, and due to that reason what a simple common people who are the worst affected because of that, because the expenses has been really skyrocketed, because the necessity items has increased tremendously within last 3-4 months, and there was basically no reason, because before that they were always giving the example that there was no proper rainfall, but this time the rainfall was very very pofka. Now in that circumstances, a Indian population doesn't have any rescue to sustain himself, and specifically a devotee who really plans himself very nicely to maintain his Krishna consciousness and the right time to retire from household life and give a 100% commitment to devotional life, finds it very difficult in these circumstances, because his household expenses used to be increased like anything. In that circumstances, what should a devotee do?
A devotee is actually maintained by Krishna. Whatever occupation you have is simply a device through which the Lord maintains his devotees. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, yoga shema vahamyaham, I preserve what you have and I bring to you what you lack in terms of needs for serving Krishna. So there'll always be these ups and downs on the earth planet because it's the middle planetary system. These phases will always be there. Somehow or other, we have to give devotees the nourishment and encouragement to not become capsized by these cycles, these phases of boom and bust. It'll always go on like that. That's the way the world is. It's not the heavenly planetary system where it's 90% smooth sailing. Earth planet's middle planetary system. If you can understand your environment, that this is the middle planetary system of mixed happiness and distress, then you will lower your expectations and you'll be prepared for this constant up, down, up, down, up, down. Now, of course, what materialistic leaders want you to think is, don't focus on the food prices, focus on the increase in the television stations. And what about the sports? There's a new cricket league or something like that? Yeah, these are the things that you should be thinking about. Look how wonderfully expansive Bollywood has become. Take pride in the national achievements. Was Pakistan defeated in the last cricket match? These are the important things. There's one former Prime Minister of New Zealand. He told me like that. This is the plan. I've explained to you before. He said there was a time when we thought people would revolt and cause a commotion, but now we know you just give them unlimited television, unlimited sports, there'll be no problem. Of course, those are materialistic plans, so therefore there will be a problem with those plans. The best made plans by materialists, they don't succeed. But still, they're thinking in that way. And then when some commotion does happen, food prices are getting too high and people are becoming disturbed, then materialists have to come up with some other way how to deal with the commotion. So they try one material solution after another. You become very weary trying to keep up with it all, you know? One minute they say the economy's like this, next minute they say the economy's like that. One minute the food supply is like this in the world, next minute is like that. There's so much cheating going on. It becomes fatiguing to try to keep up with it. So the best thing is to equip our devotees with the nourishment to not be caught up in these phases and to understand that Krishna is maintaining his devotees. Of course, maybe Krishna doesn't maintain the devotees to the material standard the devotees want, but that's another thing. Therefore, it's a very good time to learn how to live simply, as simply as possible. And then, of course, it's not that the Vaishnavas are simply saying, let Krishna figure it all out. There are ways how to organize, making food cooperatives, so many things like that. Buying food supplies in mass and distributing them to members who are the congregation. So many things like that are done in the world. So if one has the staff and the abilities and the resources, you can do like that. Mm. That way people see, oh, Vaishnavas are very practical. But ultimately it is a fact, Krishna maintains his devotees. Yes.
Thank you for the nice class. Now when we have, you're saying that this concept of Bhagavatam, the case studies that are given in Bhagavatam, they are so kind of phenomenal that they don't align with the mundane conception about how we take this world. Now, why does Srimad Bhagavatam, present these kind of scenarios vividly? Because Bhagavatam is very balanced about all these things.
Very
straightforward about these things. So, why doesn't it align with the present mundane concept in order to penetrate our intelligence or our paradigms more than rather than being switching off in the first instance? Because anybody of the present world or any intellectual takes this, he gets switched off by the initial phase itself by seeing this such kind of stories and things like that.
Really? It happened to you? You switched off?
Initially, when you present that.
But then how did you switch on?
And I'm an exception, kind of.
No, really, how did you switch on?
By being persistent, trying to
But keep, what inspired you to be persistent?
It's like some small faith, some kind of.
But where did you get that small faith from?
It's like the means and the ends are the same. So it's like whatever process you follow, that process itself gives you the result.
when you first started reading Bhagavatam, you switched off when encountering these things. But then now you switch on. So what happened? My point is you need to be in touch with the dynamics that cause that transformation so that you can assist others in making the transformation. So we should think, what happened? Formerly I was like this, now I'm like that. How is the Bhagavatam's mystic Shakti, how is it working? In my own case, I never switched off due to my particular circumstances. I could give a material explanation. I had studied all the best knowledge materially, and I had concluded even before I came to Bhagavatam that material authorities don't know what they're talking about. I was aware of all the cheating by government leaders on a national and international level. I was not so much aware of the scientific cheating, but I could easily accept that there was scientific cheating by understanding the economic and political cheating and knowing that science is not a pure pursuit of knowledge. It's heavily influenced by the economic and political realities. So, therefore, when I encountered Srimad Bhagavatam, I was, yes, anything is possible. Let me hear. Now, you may say, well, that's your case because you had already analyzed through education the nature of the material world, and you concluded they don't know what they're talking about. But it wasn't simply that material experience. It was also, I allowed myself to become overwhelmed by the power of the Bhagavatam. Where did that good fortune come from? Well, when people do devotional service, they become receptive to Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. Even by their purchasing a book, Srila Prabhupada explained that by their purchasing a book, they're doing service, and that service gives them the means to comprehend what they're reading. And then, especially when they are reading the books while being nurtured by devotees, that allows them to crash through any barriers. So I would suggest you look in your own example and see how the Association of Devotees was there, how service was there, and all these dynamics caused you to turn the switch on. Yes.
Hare Krishna. I would like to thank you for that wonderful book that was published, Bhakti Bhava, a series of lectures that you gave in, I think, Russia somewhere.
It was a secret. I didn't know that you're onto it.
It's amazing, really, very. How being the servant of Krishna is aspired by practically everyone till Nityananda Prabhu. And how everyone is looking for that bhava, actually fulfillment of the heart. And somehow they know that none of these can material things can fulfill. And they call it the emotions, dynamic emotions. So is that, I mean, like something on that rasa and also emotions. Is it exactly what thing is? We have heard in Bhakti Rasamrita, the rasa, people are looking for taste. I just wanted to know. Basically, I want to hear from you a little more about it.
What can I say except that it touches my heart very much that such esteemed Vaishnavas would appreciate my tiny attempt at service. So I will take that very seriously. I didn't know that there was, I didn't know that you all were aware of such tiny, minuscule efforts, but I'm encouraged that that you have blessed the pages by opening such a humble effort.
What would be the best prayer to Nityananda Prabhu tomorrow?
Let me think about it and I will tell you tomorrow. Hare Krishna. All right, I have to, I came in at, by the time I got here was midnight last night, but I tried my best to take this opportunity for hopefully rendering some service to such wonderful devotees and rendering service to Bhagavatam in this way, becoming a little purified. So therefore I made a special effort to come to class this morning, and then I was told that I have some university program at what time? 12:30, so I need to do some things before that, and I will speak about probably some of the points I raised today. But in a different context. So you have warmed me up and getting me ready. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Glory to you.